mother, the desire to feel something more from her. All of it came surging up. Before she knew it, she stood and threw the wooden box into the corner of the cabin, shattering it. That was when she realized she wasn't alone. She turned to find a man standing in the passageway, wearing dusty desert clothes, his turban wrapped loosely around his shoulders like a scarf.
Breath of the desert. It was Emre.
He stared at her, then the shattered remains of the box, then her again. Chade opened her mouth, but she had no idea what to say. Too many memories were flooding through her. Too many emotions. So she folded him in her arms instead. He immediately grunted, and she saw that he was in pain. She felt the bandages that wrapped his chest beneath his sweat-stained shirt.
"Ribs," he said. "It's nothing."
He took her back in his arms, held her, and bless him, said no more. Time was lost to her as the two of them became little more than their breathing bodies, their beating hearts. Chader cried against his shoulder, while Emre rubbed one hand along her back. Outside, a song played. A yelp of surprise lifted above it, followed by peals of laughter and calls for the man to do it again. Eventually she pulled away, and Emre stared into her eyes, a soft smile on his lips.
"I made it," he said.
She kissed him deeply, passionately, before wiping her tears and taking a proper look at him.
"I noticed."
Smiles broke across both their faces. They started laughing, a spontaneous thing like an amber lark taking flight.
"I tell you true," Emre began. "We nearly died a dozen times."
But he stopped when Chader held up a hand.
"Wait," she said and jutted her chin toward the sounds outside. "There's a celebration. Let's enjoy it, like we always said we would. A fire in the desert, with bread and olives and wine. You can tell me your story there."
With a grimace, Emre sketched a short bow, looking more like the Emre of old. It did her heart good to be reminded of their days with one another. He held out his arms to her.
"My lady."
She stuffed the letter and the silver vial into her purse along with the key and took his arm.
"Why, thank you, kind sir."
And then the two of them headed down the passageway, up the ladder, and into the crisp desert air.
Chapter 22. Ramad woke to darkness and chill air seeping into his bones. He was chained to a wall, his shoulders screaming from the abuse. He managed to pull himself to his feet, only to find that his legs were chained as well. Filtering down a set of stairs to his left was the barest amount of light. It was nearly silent, but he thought he could hear breathing. Someone sleeping, perhaps.
"Tiron? Chichio?"
Nothing.
"Amaryllis?"
No. The voice was deep, resonant in this confined space. "But thank you. It's good to know their names." Ramad remembered that voice. He'd heard it once through the magic of Meriem's spells. "You're Brahma. And you are in a difficult spot."
"Where are we?"
"Don't waste your breath on questions. You're going to need all the strength you can muster."
"For what?"
The sound of creaking wood interrupted the cool stillness. Footfalls came nearer, as did a dim blue glow floating in the darkness. The sapphire, Ramad realized, hanging around Brahma's neck. The cerulean light grew, casting shadows across the landscape of scars on Brahma's neck and face, making him look like a white, freshly risen from the grave and driven by thoughts of revenge.
"It was you, wasn't it, who stole into my mind those weeks ago?
Ramad tried to mask his surprise, but Brahma merely smiled, a grimacing crevice across his ruin of a face. Was it just you, I wonder? He held up a ring with a sharp protrusion on one side, a blooding ring, Ramad's ring. Do you walk the Red Ways alone? His eyes flamed blue as he stared intently at the ring, as if it, not Ramad, might answer. Or was there another? He took another step forward until he was only an arm's reach away. Ramad could see the cloth of his simple robe, his curly hair, all bathed in blue. Would you care to tell me, or would you rather I took it from you? He slipped the ring onto his thumb, so that the claw extended beyond his thumbnail. It matters little to me. Gripping Ramad's right shoulder, he used the ring to press the point into Ramad's chest. But it will save you much pain. He pressed deeper, piercing skin. Ramad's breath was forced through gritted teeth as he tried to ignore the pain. Who are you? Brahma asked. I am no one, Ramad said. No one. Brahma pulled the ring away, then made a face that revealed how young he was. No one is an interesting answer. We are all someone, are we not? Take me. I'm a thief who came to a rather tragic end and was reborn. A simple enough story, though there were days filled with leagues of pain. Now you try. Ramad had assumed Tiran had been taken, perhaps Amaryllis and Chichio too. But if he was asking such simple questions, the assumptions didn't make sense. I come from the sea. Brahma wagged his head from side to side, as if this were a reasonable response. And now that you're here in Sharakai, where do you spend your time? In your mother's bedchamber. Brahma gave a pitiless smile. Very well. There was no malice in the way he said it, which made it all the more chilling. Reaching out, he took Ramad's head in his hands. The warmth in them was inhuman. He could smell the fennel and garlic on his breath. The point of his own ring was now pressed against his left eye. Ramad was sure Brahma was going to use the ring to put his eye out, but he didn't. He gripped Ramad's head tighter and sent him crashing into the stone wall, once, twice, a third time. A sea of lights swam in the darkness before him. He could feel himself blacking out, but he breathed deeply, fighting it. Your name? Brahma tried again. Tiny, Ramad replied. Like your cock. I tire of this, came a voice. It was ephemeral and distant, as if spoken from the depths of a dark forest. Give him to me. A silence followed, and then Brahma said, Very well. The sensations of this place, the grit on the floor, the dampness in the cool air, the sounds of the city floating down from above, were replaced by the presence of another mind. It felt so similar to joining his mind with Meriem's, that for a moment he thought it was Meriem. But it wasn't. This was a more ancient soul, wilder, more violent. It felt as if the desert itself had come to pick Ramad apart and examine him, bit by bit. Rumayesh. It must be Rumayesh. But the knowledge gave him no comfort. It was all he could do to fight down his fear. He's Chimeri, the Irek said. Even that small piece of information felt like a violation, as if it were a gateway that would lead to the loss of everything else. Ramad tried to raise a defense,
tried to sap the power from this spell as he had done against Hamsakir in the desert. But he was weak and he was wounded, and in the end stood no chance against the cruel advance of Rumayesh's will. The Erek's presence enshrouded him, picked at the edges of his mind like a swarm of wood wasps. His terror grew as he tried to think of something, anything that might save him. He didn't wish to die like this, in darkness away from those he loved, his mind lost.
"You might be freed!"
Ramad shouted desperately, and incredibly, Rumayesh's unrelenting advance slowed, then halted.
"I might be freed,"
Rumayesh cooed.
"And who would free me? You?"
"Yes," Brahma laughed, though it was Rumayesh who controlled him.
"Are you so kind?" she asked with his mouth. "To free one such as me."
Brahma's hand trailed down Ramad's cheek to his neck and along his naked chest.
"Is your heart so charitable?"
Ramad swallowed. He wished he hadn't.
"Wouldn't it be better than where you are?"
To his surprise, he felt a pang of doubt, and it was coming from Brahma. This was a fear that plagued him in the darkest moments of his days, the thought of losing the sapphire, and Rumayesh with it. The thought was hardly there before it vanished.
"That depends on your perspective," Rumayesh said. "Were I you, a man whose life is gone in the blink of an eye, I might agree. But imagine you had more days to your name. Imagine your dark father, Goshen, granting you undying life. Might you not want to experience more?"
Rumayesh pressed the sharpened point of Ramad's ring into the skin, just over his madly beating heart.
"Things you might never have thought of. I would never accept being imprisoned."
"Imprisoned?" she scoffed.
"Who speaks of prisons? I ride a river. To what end, I do not know, but I know that it has led me to places I would never have found otherwise. A life of meager means along the flood-prone banks of the Khadar. A host of lives who intersect with Brahmas in devastating ways, showing life's cruelty with an honesty I'd never known before. There is beauty in that chaos."
Brahma's smile widened.
"Take you, for example."
Brahma's fingers trailed up Ramad's skin, raked through his hair as a lover might.
"I wonder where the stream of your mind will take us."
Brahma's bright green eyes, so intent, stared deeply into Ramad's. The swarm of wasps had returned. Louder than before, they stung. They delved into his mind.
"Perhaps to Masid Ishakava,"
Rumayesh said easily.
"Who slew your wife and child?"
They bore deeper, the pain intensifying.
"To Chidamin, Ayaneshala, the white wolf."
The sound was deafening, the buzzing, the chittering.
"To your queen, Meriam Shan Alduan." "Mighty Alu, lend me strength."
Ramad pushed harder against her. He was somehow managing to keep her at bay, but for how long? The din of the insects was maddening.
"Come," Rumayesh said. "Allow me in of your own free will. I'm afraid the alternative might leave you a bit tattered."
Ramad's fear was so great he nearly gave in. But in that moment, the memory of a room in a distant tower came to him. Not his own memory, but Brahma's. He saw Rumayesh in her true form. Hooved feet, taurine legs, a forked tail that swished this way, then that. A crown of thorns and two horns sweeping back from her forehead. Worst were her depthless eyes and the dark humour in them. For all she had done to Brahma, for what she was about to do. The memory dimmed as Brahma mastered his emotions, though Rumayesh seemed pleased, amused, not only by Ramad's fear, but Brahma's. She was delighted that even after all the time they'd spent together, Brahma still viewed those days with unbridled terror.
"You are a wicked demon," Ramad said through gritted teeth.
"Perhaps, but I get what I want." The pressure on Ramad's mind intensified, becoming a gale of wind and sand and biting stone. The insects consuming flesh, bone and blood. As he had with Hamzakir months ago, Ramad tried to resist, tried to snuff the Erek's power before it became too great, but it was impossible. He was too fatigued, and how could he, a mortal man, stand against a creature forged by the hand of Goshen? His walls fell altogether, but in that moment something brightened deep within his mind, as if it had been waiting for him to reach his lowest point. This new presence stormed forth, grabbing Rumayesh, lashing at Brahma, bullying forward as they tried to raise their defenses against this new threat. An anguished cry escaped Brahma's throat, though whether it was from Brahma or Rumayesh or both of them, Ramad wasn't sure. Brahma fell. He scrambled away as the light in the sapphire went out, plunging the room into darkness. Ramad heard something scraping across the cell floor, heard Brahma's panicked breathing. He felt Brahma's terror as Miriam. Ramad was certain it was her, clawed through his mind. She had to reach Brahma, Ramad realized, and through him she would reach Rumayesh. Rumayesh may have realized this as well, for even though she was fearful of Miriam's power, she acted with a calculated calm, pressing on Brahma's mind as well, squeezing him from both sides. She was trying to stop Miriam from reaching her. Miriam knew it, and she tried to bolster Brahma's defenses, to keep him awake long enough for her to take both Brahma and Rumayesh, while they were so intent on Ramad. Ramad tried to help as well, but what could he do? He was but a locust caught in a terrible storm. In the end, Rumayesh pushed too hard, and Brahma succumbed to the weight of the onslaught. He fell limp, and in that moment a brightness blasted Ramad's mind so quickly, so forcefully, there was nothing he could do to prevent it. Then the brilliance was gone, and Ramad was falling into darkness. Ramad woke, feeling as though his arms were being ripped from their sockets. He was still chained to the wall of the cellar. The same bare light filtered in from the stairs to his left. Brahma was now a vague, man-shaped smudge in the darkness of the dirt floor.
"How long have I been under?"
Not long, he thought. Surely Brahma's army would have checked on him at some point. Ramad pulled himself tall, feeling along the wall behind him. He touched the iron hoop where the chain looped through it and around his wrists. Feeling with his bare feet, he found a second hoop. His fingertips touched the iron spike in the wall, which had been driven into the mortar between the stones. Secure enough if the mortar was fresh, but this was an old home with old foundations. Wrapping the chain around both hands, he yanked it down. It held. Taking a deep breath, he tried again, pulling his legs up until those chains pulled tight as well.
Like the string of a bow drawing the ends closer, he drew on the chains, pulling with all his might.
They didn't budge.
Moments later, he heard a door creak and footsteps walking across the floor above him. His fear over what they would do when they found Brahma unconscious sent his fear soaring. He pulled again, heedless of how bright the pain in his joints was, of how deeply it cut into the skin of his ankles.
Brahma moaned in the darkness.
A wheezing grunt escaped Ramad as he heaved against the chain. He became a part of it, as unyielding as steel. At the top of the stairs came a knock.
Brahma?
A woman's voice, muted behind the closed door. Ramad pulled harder, and finally something gave. With a sound like shearing steel, he fell hard to the floor, and the chains clanked down loudly around him. He reached into the darkness, felt Brahma's ankle. He dragged him closer, once, then again. He patted along Brahma's waist and found a leather belt, a ring of keys. The door creaked open. Candlelight flooded the stairwell, pushing back the darkness.
Brahma!
Ramad pulled the ring free and felt each of the three keys, trying to judge which might unlock the chains. But as the footsteps came nearer, he simply tried the first one on his ankle. It was wrong, but the second one fit. And when he turned it, he felt the sweet release of the mechanism.
Stop!
He heard the woman call. The light wavered wildly as he unlocked the second shackle. He threw the chains off and rolled backward and onto his feet, just as her lithe form swept forward in the gloom. He was just able to avoid the sweep of her knife. He backed away as she swiped again, warding away the knife with the chain he now held between his hands. As she came in a third time, he flicked the chain around her wrist, trapped it, and pulled her close. She tried to recover, to adjust the blade and slash him across his right arm, but he was able to control her movement by tightening the chain. He headbutted her, slipped a foot behind her ankle, and sent her spilling to the ground. From there, it was simple to wrap an arm around her neck, still keeping the knife secure, and choke her until she lost consciousness. He moved quickly after that. The keys were where he'd dropped them. After unlocking the chains around his wrists, he retrieved the woman's candle from the stairs where she'd left it and brought it near Brahma, scanning for the sapphire. It wasn't around Brahma's neck, but had been thrust away as he had fallen back. He could hardly believe it. He picked it up and found it was heavy, like lead instead of crystal. It was wrapped in leather cord, covered in something sticky, sooty. But for all that, as simple as it appeared, he could tell he was holding a thing of power. He became so transfixed, he lost track of time until he realized minutes had passed. Shaking his head, he remembered the fierce battle that had sent Rumayesh into hiding. He had no idea what had happened to Meriem, but he had to get back to her. But what to do with Brahma? He took up the knife of the woman who tried to kill him, then approached Brahma carefully. By the gods, his mouth was working. His head lolled from side to side, but he didn't open his eyes, not even when the light from the candle came near. Ramad stood over him. Meriem might have use for him, but given how many zealots had decided to throw their lot in with him, he had power, and that power made him dangerous. He stared at the scars that crisscrossed Brahma's face, his neck, the skin of his hands. He had no idea what had happened to the man, but it was likely a mercy to do what he did now, which was to run the knife across Brahma's throat. Blood ran in gouts as he turned to the woman. She was young. She could still make a life for herself. She might rally those loyal to Brahma, but given their nature, men and women who not so long ago had been addicted to Black Lotus, he doubted they would stay with her for long, not without their savior. In the end, Ramad let her be. He moved upstairs, found his boots and sword on a table in the simple home, and left.
Chapter 23. Davood trudged toward the blooming fields. King Sukru was by his side, walking like an old hyena, crook-backed, bald pate and hungry, piercing eyes, the sort of creature a pack might devour rather than be slowed down. As had been true the last time they'd come, both Xander and a silver spear accompanied them, but unlike last time they were dragging between them a bound and gagged man, one of the few scarabs who had survived the night of endless swords. Ahead, the blooming fields sketched an imperfect line toward the horizon. The thorny Adhikara branches were motionless. The air was still, as if the trees were wrapped, waiting to see what the king and Davood were preparing to do.
"My lord king," Davood began, "might we speak of the man we've brought?" "The scarab,"
Sukru spat as he led them through a gap in the trees. Within was a sizable clearing. Along the far side of it lay a swathe of trees that looked different from the rest. Healthy Adhikara with large, thorny bushes that choked the space around their thick, gnarled base. Their branches were brown, with tinges of green near the ends that matched the small, spade-shaped leaves. The famed blooms were encased in indigo buds. The trees Sukru led him toward were blackened, with few leaves and fewer buds. Unlike on Betsair, when Sukru had brought him to a lone tree, here was a wide swathe of disease that went deeper into the grove. A dozen trees clustered together like children lost in the desert, huddled, crying, dying.
"All I ask, my lord king," Davood went on, "is that you allow me to apply the knife."
Ignoring Davood, Sukru motioned the silver spear to bring the prisoner before him. The spear complied, forcing the man to his knees, while Sukru swung his withering gaze to Davood.
"Why?"
Xander, standing behind Sukru, was shaking his head, a warning for Davood to go no farther. But Davood had made up his mind. The prisoner was hardly more than a boy. He was thin and malnourished, with a haggard expression that gave some hint to the horrors he had seen as a prisoner of the king's. He was trying to put on a brave face. One last defiant act before he died, perhaps, but his eyes betrayed him. They shifted nervously between Sukru and Davood. He no more wished to die than he wanted to kiss Sukru's feet.
"When we last came here, I suspect I could have learned more had the tribute not died. If I might be allowed to take some of his blood while he lives, perhaps we can go further than we did that night."
Davood thought no such thing, but satisfying Sukru's curiosity over the dying Adhikara wasn't worth a life. Growing up in Rose Ridge, Davood had known many like this young scarab. He might not agree with the path to peace was through war, but that didn't mean he couldn't save a life when there was no need for it to be taken.
"There was no mention of this in the book I gave you," Sukru said. "Nor the one Khamsakir left you."
"No,"
Davood replied, hoping he didn't sound too eager.
"It was something Khamsakir said when he confessed his nature and my own. He said the Erek hunger not for blood alone, but the blood of the living. I would try this with a living soul."
For long moments, Sukru's eyes searched Davood's. Then he looked to the scarab as if he had pissed on Sukru's curl-toed shoes.
"His lifeblood can still be spilled if I'm wrong, my lord king."
He hadn't wanted to say it, but everything about Sukru spoke to the desire to end this man's life. He'd been anticipating it since Sharakai, Davood realized,
I should have spoken sooner, but there had been precious little time. He had only seen him for a moment as he boarded Sukru's yacht, and the king had immediately hidden himself away in the rear cabin. From the sheath at his belt, Sukru pulled a broad-bladed kanshar. From the sour look on his face, Davud thought he was going to run it across the scarab's throat just to spite him and his pet theory, but after a moment he held it out, hilt first.
"The gods forbid we end the life of a filthy scarab!"
Davud tried his best to hide his relief, but was unsure how successful he had been given how churlishly Sukru was watching him. He ignored it as he flicked his fingers for the young man to move closer to the diseased Adhikara. When he refused, the silver spear took him roughly by the arms and dragged him there.
"Give me your hand," Davud said.
The man's breath came faster now.
"Please, not my soul."
Xander backhanded him. When he still refused, the silver spear grabbed him by the neck and choked him until his face turned red.
"Please don't!"
Davud cried. The spear didn't listen, and then Xander was wrenching his arm away from his body, preparing it for Davud.
"Baki, please don't let this end in death."
As Davud brought the knife near, the scarab's face turned hard.
"No!"
he shouted and leaned back and kicked Davud in the face. Davud reeled as pain blossomed across his cheek and nose. He thumped against the sand, falling just short of having his face raked on an Adhikara's thorns. He rose to the sound of Sukru laughing. It was a low rumble, like thunder in the distance, but it grew the longer Sukru stared. Soon the king was gripping his knees.
"Would you spare him now?"
Davud tenderly touched his nose to see if it was bleeding. Thankfully it wasn't. He could only imagine Sukru's laughter if it had been. With the pain subsiding, he moved more carefully toward the young man.
"I only need a bit of your blood."
The scarab was shaking his head furiously.
"I would die before I give it to you." "Well then?"
Before Davud realized what was happening, Sukru snatched a thin knife from Xander's belt.
"Your wish is granted." "No!"
Davud shouted, but it was too late. Sukru drew the knife sharply across the young man's throat and threw him against the diseased Adhikara. The scarab, Davud realized he'd never learned his name, clutched at his throat. His legs kicked, scoring deep furrows in the sand.
"Not another word, boy,"
Sukru said, as he handed the knife back to Xander, who accepted it with a grim, accusatory look at Davud, as if Davud had been the killer.
"Now get on with it."
Davud was petrified by Sukru's cruelty, and angry with himself for not finding some way through it. The scarab stared at Davud, blinking, fingers clutching, and then slowly he went still. In that moment he couldn't help but think of Chayda and her plight, the secrets she was trying to uncover, the cruelty she hoped to end. And here he was, a willing participant in that same cruelty. He wanted Hamzakir to pay for all he'd done, but first Davud had to learn more about his abilities and the cruel realities of this ancient conflict.
"I advise you to find another mage when you return to Sharakai,"
Hamzakir had told him in Ishmantep.
"It won't be easy, and I suspect before long one will find you. One you mightn't like to have as your master, so work quickly."
Davud did have a master now, and he wasn't at all sure he liked him. Sukru's stare became more intense.
"I'll not ask you again."
"Of course, my lord king."
Davud knelt on the ground beside the young man.
"May Baki deliver you swiftly to the Father Fields."
Then he touched his fingers to the blood that oozed from the slit in the young man's throat. He used it to draw sigils on his palms. The first combined subsume with the sigil the Firefinch had given him, a sigil he had come to call Delve, for the feelings of burrowing and deepening it seemed to bring about.
The other encompassed several from the book Sukru had given him, sigils for graft and grow. In Sukru's book, Davud had learned of blood magi who used multiple sigils at the same time. The mage would, as the author had put it, grip the sigils, which would in turn summon the desired effect. He hoped this combination would allow him to delve more deeply than he had the last time, so that he could learn why some of the Adhikara trees were beginning to wither and die. That done, he retrieved an ampule from the pouch at his belt, filled it carefully with blood, and then downed it in one swallow. He was no longer new to the taste of blood, but the raw potency of it still awed him. Just as it had when he'd snuffed the flames in Ishmantep, it offered him enough power to do whatever he wished. He forced it into the earth, trailing after the blood that had seeped below the surface. He felt the roots combine, felt them merge and merge again to form the trunk, felt them divide and divide again as the branches fought for space with its brethren. As his awareness grew, he willed them to tell their story, limiting himself to the ones that were diseased. The dozen trees before him were strong in his mind, a life like his and yet unlike it. These trees had lived through the ages since their quickening at Tulathan's hand. Suddenly a vision swept him up. A woman, tall with plaited blonde hair, carried a gnarled wooden staff, the head of which looked like a cobra spreading its hood. The woman had seen 40 summers, perhaps. She was broad-shouldered, with a broad, handsome face to match, not unlike the first men and women depicted in the frescoes of Yorinde's temple. The desert's harsh sun drove down, creating stark shadows against the sand as she walked. As she approached the blooming fields, the branches leaned away as if she were a flame, unbearable to be near. Upon reaching a clearing, she knelt before an Adhikara and put her staff down. For a time she breathed, eyes closed, arms to her side, palms outward, as if she were feeling the rhythms of the grove. The sun stretched toward sunset. At the precise moment it kissed the horizon, she leaned forward and blew upon the base of the Adhikara before her. Sand and stone lifted like dust, revealing ever more of the knobbly trunk as it dug deeper into the earth. Again she blew, and a third time, until the moss-like roots were revealed. Her hand scraped the rough bark. Her fingers clutched the roots. The moment was dizzying, for Davud felt himself at the same time kneeling beside a similar tree while a king named Sukru stood near and a dead man lay close enough to touch.
"Who are you?"
he wanted to ask, but his courage was failing him. Then he was drawn down, down, down into the earth, and he couldn't tell which of them it was happening to.
"Both, you fool."
Deep into the earth he went, the roots creeping through stone, along tunnels, through gaps, into caverns large and small. The roots filled cracks and crevices, wriggling ever deeper, a great coalescing as they fused with one another to form a trunk.
"All of them," Davud realized. "All them, as if the individual trees are nothing more than the leaves of a grand arboreal organism, growing beneath the bedrock of Sharakai itself."
But if that was so, why were some of the branches dying? The roots met in a cavern. They coated the walls, reached up to the very center of the cavern's high roof, where they braided into a thick clump that grew thinner, thinner, until only one small tendril was left. From that distal thread, moisture dripped, patterning against the stone that lay below. And the stone, it glowed violet, like a heavenly body being fed and nurtured within the womb of that very cavern. Davud didn't know the nature of it, but it was certain the Adhikara had created it. Their roots had been guided here by unseen hands, so that their essence might feed this stone. But what was that essence? It wasn't water.
and it certainly wasn't blood. Before Davood could think further, he was swept back to the desert. The woman lifted her head, suddenly wary and afraid. She turned the way she'd come, then stood, picking up her staff. Her brow furrowed in concentration as the dying light of dusk lit the desert red. From beyond the line of trees there came a snuffing sound, a huffing. Lumbering toward her were a pair of dark forms, animals with rigid backs and heads held low. They had thick fur with long black spines along the shoulders and back. Desert hyenas, black laughers, bone crushers, except these two were much larger than those that typically roamed the desert. They sniffed along the stone where the woman had entered the blooming field, a path now blocked by the poisonous branches of the Adhikara. Still they tried, growling as they pushed their massive heads into the undergrowth. When the woman moved in the other direction, the trees parted and the black laughers sensed it. One backed away from the Adhikara, yipping. The other laughed its chilling laugh. Then both tipped their heads back and howled to the darkling sky. The woman reached the sand, but already she could hear more of the black laughers on this side of the Adhikara. There were three, no, four, sprinting toward her, while tails of sand kicked up behind them. She held her ground, ready for battle. When the nearest came close, she swung her staff, caught the beast across the jaw and sent it flying, its massive head lolling. It struck the sand and lay still. The others fanned out, refusing to come in range of her staff. She sprinted forward so fast that the largest of the beasts had no time to back away and caught it on the top of its skull. It was driven down, but the others were darting in now, and more laughers were approaching. Jaws snapped and throats growled. Those farther away yowled. One bit her leg. Another lunged and clamped its jaws around her wrist before she managed to tear it away. With a grand wave of her staff, the Adhikara came alive. The branches reached out, grabbing the fetlocks of the nearest laugher. A second was grabbed by its neck. Then a third by its snout, the thorns refusing to let go no matter how much it snapped and struggled. More branches wrapped around their legs and barrel chests, then drew the laughers into the groves, where thicker branches wrapped them and squeezed. They whimpered and whined as the trees tore them apart. Then the Adhikaras went still. The remaining bone crushers backed away, then laughed louder, longer, higher than before. A smell pervaded the deepening night. A scent like myrrh and loam and burning pitch. Fear lit the woman's features as she turned toward the bright horizon. Silhouetted by the sun's dying light was a massive figure. Black skin, a crown of thorns, legs like a bull's. Two tails lashed the air behind it. It was Gojin, who traveled with a pack of bone crushers, the elders of those that plagued the desert. He held a javelin loosely in one hand and was approaching at a walk, but then he seemed to recognize the woman, for he smiled and began to lope forward. She lifted her staff high, gripping it with both hands. Putting her whole body into one savage movement, she speared the tip into the ground between her feet. It sunk a foot into the stone. Eyes closed, she whispered to the head of the staff. From the point where the staff entered the ground, the earth split. A crack formed and shot forward like lightning, running toward Gojin in a jagged line, then cutting beneath him. The gap widened, earth fell away, and Gojin had to scramble, stabbing his javelin into the wall of the crevice that had formed. He tried to climb out, but the earth came snapping back, trapping him from the waist down. Gojin reared as the shaking of the earth began to quell and the stone pressed ever inward. It was crushing him,
but Gojan was not done. He pressed his arms against the ground and with a roar lifted one leg free of the earth. The ground beneath him tore as he climbed out. The woman, surely, she was Nalame. Who else would oppose Gojan? Was whispering again. Gojan, however, seemed ready. He lifted his javelin, took two long strides, and sent it flying through the air. It flew true and struck Nalame in the chest. She shattered, breaking into pieces as if she were made stone. Indeed, her skin and clothes had dulled, turned an amber color. She fell apart like a statue at the strike of an iron maul. Gojan neared, crouched low, lips pulled back in shock and anger. His jaundiced eyes narrowed. He leaned to one side, sniffing, scrutinizing. Nothing happened, however, until he took another step. The stones burst, exploding with a sound that shook the earth. Gojan reared back as a sound like chittering insects filled the air. Chunks of stone and scree fell to the ground. As the sound died away, a great cloud of dust was borne on the breeze. Gojan pulled a thick shard of stone from the meat of his thigh where it had been driven by the explosion. He pulled more from his chest and arms. Black blood flowed, slicking the fur along the joints of his taurine legs. He stared, hands balled into fists at his sides, his face and chest and arms bleeding from a dozen wounds. His entire body tensed, and the god of chaos released a bellow of rage. As it rang through the dusk, Davud was returned to himself, though the sound still echoed in his mind. But Gojan was gone. Gone were the black laughers, gone the brilliant sunset. Instead, Davud found himself staring at the trunk of the Adhikara before him. By his side, the dead scarab lay, flies crawling on his eyes and lips, slipping inside his open mouth. Xander stood nearby and seemed surprised when Davud lifted himself up off the ground and came to a stand. Davud ignored him. He couldn't shake the feeling that there were black laughers near, that Gojan was coming. Had Nalame been here? But no.
How long? Davud asked.
6 hours,
Xander replied, eyeing Davud as if he expected him to sprout reptilian legs and crawl into the sand. He held out a skin of water. Davud accepted it gratefully, drank deeply, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
There were black laughers. In the dream, I mean.
He stopped, for Xander was shaking his head grimly.
This story isn't for my ears.
He motioned Davud to the way back.
Best get on. The king's been anxious for you to wake.
Soon Davud was back on the yacht, sitting in Sukru's cabin as the deck tilted easily with the slope of the dunes. He shared his vision, most of it in any case. He withheld the part about Nalame and Gojan. He wanted more time to think, to speak with someone he trusted.
If only his old collegia master Amelos were still alive.
Sukru's eyes stared past Davud as if Sukru had just learned he was dying.
The cavern! What sort of stone?
He barked after a time. Davud shrugged.
It looked like crystal, but not faceted. It was smooth and violet light glowed from within.
He paused, waiting for Sukru to ask more. When he didn't, Davud asked,
Is there any such cavern?
Sukru's mouth worked. He seemed restless, worried. His eyes flitted to and fro as if he were lost in some grand equation he couldn't quite solve.
Leave me.
Of course, my lord king.
And Davud?
Sukru said when he was halfway through the door.
You will speak of this to no one.
Never, my lord king.
The way Sukru had said it, Davud already knew he shouldn't tell anyone. Sukru had given that order before they'd taken their first voyage to the Blooming Fields, The very fact that Sukru had said it again, with such a malevolent look on his face, made Davood realize just how dangerous it was to be party to this information. That made two things perfectly clear. First, Sukru hadn't known about the cavern, and second, now that he did know, he was worried.
The patience of a butterfly and the anger of a bull,
the sparrow had said of Sukru. Although Davood believed those words, he hadn't felt their weight. Not until now. He spent the return voyage wondering if Sukru would storm in and run a knife across Davood's throat as he had done to the scarab. Chapter 24. Several days passed after unexpectedly finding Emre in Leora's yacht. They were busy days. Chayda met what felt like a thousand people. She heard tales. She helped to unload food and water and firewood from the ships for a feast held over the course of the day. She learned how to make a sour flatbread that had a thin, crispy, almost burnt shell and a soft, airy interior. Coupled with a rich tagine of lamb, potato, tomato, eggplant and rosemary, it was divine. She tasted a dozen other dishes as well. Buttery saffron rice in the morning, a simple meal of pears and cheese near midday, the bread and tagine as the sun was lowering. Leora finished Chayda's tattoo. Staring at the finished image in a mirror, Chayda felt proud. To have her own story inked indelibly into her skin by the hand of her own great-grandmother was a thing she couldn't have imagined a year ago. The image and its making bridged the distance between their generations, a weave that encompassed not only the two of them, but Aya, Ishak and Masid as well. After 2 days of celebration, the mood of the tribe sobered. They had a purpose here, and the dangers mounted the longer they remained. Ishak held council for long hours of each day. Most of those attending, Masid, Dadzada, Darius, Hamid the Cruel, as he had come to be called, a broad-faced woman named Shalalara who was said to have more lives than a cat and more, had been leaders in the Moonless Host. The lines between the host and the tribe had become so blurred that they were all now de facto tribe elders. Only once was Chayda summoned, and then only to recount her story for the elders to hear for themselves. She answered a few questions, but it was clear they already knew most of her tale. She had hoped to speak to Ishak about her plans to return to Sharakai, to make her case clearly and calmly, but she was dismissed before she had a chance. She had gone to Ishak several times after, hoping they might come to some accord, but he had rebuffed her each time, making it clear to Chayda how poorly she had handled herself the other day. She shouldn't have been so impolitic, especially at their first meeting. She had created a rift between them and now was having trouble finding a way to mend it. Wait, and he might assume she had decided to join the tribe and cede her will to his, but push too hard or too quickly, and it would cement his impression of her as an immature girl, filled with fire and brimstone and little else. On her fifth day at camp, several ships prepared to sail. They didn't want to risk the whole tribe being together for so long, not just yet. So they ordered those ships carrying the tribe's eldest and the mothers and the youngest of the children to sail for one of the safe havens the Moonless Host had used over the years. The rest would take to the sands the next day, following one final council. The ships eventually departed. Chayda thought Ishak might come to bid the ships farewell, but he didn't, and when sunset neared, Chayda began to worry that he now assumed Chayda was part of the tribe. He might not give her a chance to speak after all. The council still hadn't broken, and the morning would be consumed as the rest of the tribe prepared to leave. Swallowing an urge to walk into the pavilion and demand that Ishak speak with her, she went to Leora's yacht, hoping to ask for her advice. Salsana was there, sitting on one of the runners. Jada made to head up the gangway, but Salsana rose to her impressive, full height and stepped in Jada's path.
Leora will be along soon.
The way she'd said it, so matter-of-factly, reminded Jada of her mother's manner, which in turn reminded her of the strange way she'd closed her letter.
Who is Devora?
She asked Salsana. Salsana brushed the sand from the back of her blue skirt with the sort of absent care that made it clear just how much she was surprised by the question.
How do you know that name?
It was in a letter my mother left to me. She said to trust Leora and Devora, for they both see beyond the horizon.
Devora was Leora's twin sister. She died when they were young. Your age, in fact.
Died? How?
Salsana glanced at the gangway leading down from the ship, perhaps nervous that Leora might hear her.
Years ago, the Sheikh of Tribe Rafik sheltered Leora and Devora, but Sukru somehow found them and demanded Leora as his bride. On the morning Leora was to depart for Sharakai, Devora went to Sukru's ship. She posed as Leora and told him before the crew and the entire tribe that she would never consent, nor would any other woman from the tribe. She would die first, or if forced to go to Sharakai, then she would kill him as he slept.
She glanced at the ship again and lowered her voice before continuing.
It said she drew a knife right there and then and tried to cut Sukru's neck. Sukru seemed to know she would try. He took the knife from her and drove it into her belly, dragged her to the edge of the deck, and threw her down to the sand. With Devora dying below, Sukru stared out over the tribe. None had known what Devora planned, and they were shocked. But they now stared defiantly at Sukru, as though each and every woman there was ready to treat Devora's threat as her own. After spitting into Devora's lifeless body, Sukru returned to Sharakai. Many considered it a victory, but it had left Leora without her sister. As the king's galleon sailed away, she lay on the sand by Devora's side. She took the amethyst ring from her, the one she wears to this day, as a remembrance of the sacrifice her sister had made.
Out in the desert, Kerim wailed. It sent shivers down Chada's spine. She knew the sort of man Sukru was. Gods, the very thought of being married to him made her blood run cold.
I don't doubt your tale, but why would my mother ask me to listen to them both, as if Devora was still alive?
Salsana shrugged.
Leora won't admit it, but she talks to the ring. She's said now and again that both she and Devora agreed on this or that. I think something broke her in the day Devora died. When it did, she placed the broken pieces into that ring, along with her love for her sister.
A hollow thumping sound came from the yacht, and Leora emerged.
Are you telling stories about me again?
She stood bent to one side, her cane helping to support her. Salsana helped her down the gangway.
Would you rather I didn't?
Leora smiled slyly.
Depends on which story. Only the good ones,
Salsana replied.
Well then,
Leora said, winking at Jada.
Tell all you like.
Behind them, the elders of the tribe were stepping out of the pavilion. Another long wail fell across the sand, and many turned to look, including Ishak. Jada could see his silhouette standing just outside the entrance, back lit in gold. Leora's story had sparked something in Kerim. Jada could feel his hatred for Sukru, as well as a burning desire to obey him. She felt the same conflicted feelings from him toward Ishak as on the morning they'd met several days before, a familial bond coupled with a deep-seated yearning to end his life. Suddenly, all of Cheda's worries over what to do with Ishak vanished like winter fog.
"Can you wait here a moment?"
she asked Salsana and Leora. Confused, they both nodded. Cheda ran toward the pavilion. The elders turned